Hello and welcome to The Reset, a mental health podcast without all the bollocks. I'm Sam Delaney. My guest this week is the writer Peter Warmby. Peter was diagnosed as autistic when he was 34, after which aspects of his life started to make more sense to him, including his struggles with his mental health. There are a huge number of people living with autism in the UK and thousands more who are believed to be undiagnosed. While being neurodivergent isn't an illness, it can present numerous challenges that lead to mental health problems. Quite a few listeners have got in touch with me over the past few months to tell me about Peter's book, Untypical, which spells out vividly all of these issues and more. As Peter puts it, just like computers have a variety of different operating systems, humans have many different types of brain, something it's important for us all to understand. So I was delighted that Peter spared the time to come on The Reset and explain a bit more about all of this. I hope you enjoy listening to our chat. Peter Warmby, welcome to The Reset.
Hello, thank you for having me. It's really nice to have an opportunity to talk.
Yeah, it's great to be speaking to you. I've heard a lot about your book, and actually some listeners to the show have reached out to me more than one occasion and said that, you know, it had an impact on them and that they'd love to hear you on this podcast. So I'm really delighted that you've agreed to come on and tell us all about it. Peter, what's your personal journey towards this? You know, I know this is your second book, Untypical, which came out this year. It's doing really, really well. You were a teacher before you became a kind of full-time writer and speaker. What's the story behind that?
Good question. It's all very tightly wound up with the diagnosis that I had when I was 34, so about 6 years ago now. I was diagnosed as a result of really struggling to cope with becoming a parent, because it threw everything into such disarray that all of my kind of systems that I'd subconsciously put into place just kind of fell apart. So I was really struggling with my mental health, depression, massive anxiety, you know, on medication, all the usual stuff. But I wanted to know if there was something more going on there. I had my inkling that there was. So I looked into it and got the GP to agree with me and got the diagnosis. And that kicked it all off, really. I was still a teacher at that point. I'd been a teacher at that point for nearly 10 years. And I had no real intention of not becoming, you know, not being a teacher. I just, you know, I tend to just go with the easiest possible flow. Mm. And at that point, just carrying on as I was would have been, you know, straightforward. But I started writing about my experience. I started short form on Twitter and longer blog posts, that kind of thing. And it got some traction, and people were interested and seemed to enjoy the way I wrote about it. Mm. And, you know, through one way or another, that led to publishers coming to me and saying, would you like to write a book for us? I didn't seek it out at all. I feel like a real, it's incredibly lucky. And I feel, you know, I've got to be grateful for that, because I'm not very proactive as a person. You know, I tend to just take what comes. Yeah. And so, you know, I had Jessica Kingsley approached me about the first book. That was way back here before the pandemic, I think, that we first started talking about that. And then I got an agent, and then HarperCollins had been in touch wanting me to, you know, to think about writing for them. And we organized that. And it all came about thanks to social media. It all really came about thanks to Twitter, which is a shame given what's happened since. I don't really use it anymore, but that definitely got me on my way. And then the pandemic happened, and we didn't go into school for a while because of that, you know, because of lockdown. But my anxiety around COVID was quite high. And I struggled to go back in, and my mental health was still shot. So I had to take that decision to try and pour all of my effort into writing and doing workplace talks and all of that stuff that we do, and lose the, you know, the steady salary and pension, etc., of being a teacher. So that was a gamble. That was a real gamble. But my mental health meant that I didn't really have all that much choice. weirdly, it felt like I did at the time, but looking back, I don't think I really did. You know, I think it was a situation where I had to do what I did. I'm just glad that I've survived since.
Well, I'm glad you've done so, and that you seem to be, you know, the book is obviously doing really well. You seem to be thriving, but I'd love to go back to, you know, your diagnosis, because, you know, the difficulty you faced coping with being a new parent is something that we talk about a lot on this podcast with all my different guests. It's something that I went through as well, and there are different reasons for it. But when you say that, you know, you had an inkling there was something more to it, what were the signs in your mind? Was this something that you'd had sort of even before parenthood, that you'd had sort of certain question marks about things inside your own personality?
Yes, I think so. I was never able to put a label on it for many, many years. But I knew that on a very fundamental level, I struggled with things that I shouldn't struggle with, you know, shouldn't in inverted commas. I struggled with things that everyone else seemed to find relatively straightforward. I pushed myself very hard to do things that I had an instinctive dread of doing, often to my own detriment. So things like socializing too much, going out when I really didn't want to, you know, little things, but it all added up. And I just always felt like everything was an uphill battle, whereas it didn't seem like it was that for a lot of the people that I was around. It just felt like I was incredibly rubbish at life,
right?
If that makes sense. Like I was absolutely dreadful at coping with everything, really, from finances to organization to socializing to just a straightforward conversation, small talk in the corridor, that kind of thing. Every single thing, apart from a few things where I knew I was quite good, like I knew I was a relatively good teacher. I was confident about that because I knew my stuff and I had a decent rapport with the students. And I knew that I had certain skills, like I knew that I could write. I knew that I could... I was good at video games, you know, but apart from those things, I was a failure. You know, I was an abject, hopeless mess. And as I got older, I just started to think more, well, maybe there's a reason for that. Maybe it shouldn't be something to hate myself over. Maybe it should be something for me to actually look into in a bit more detail. And of course, I've been made aware of the existence of autism through work, primarily, because as a teacher, you know, you work with a lot of autistic students. So I had that sort of drip fed to me over time. But the trouble is, the training that we got on autism wasn't very good, to be honest.
Right.
It was it was very much wedded to old stereotypes and things like that. So I had a real kind of realization that no, it can't be that, because I don't know. I've been in like a rock band when I was in my 20s, you know, I was a front man.
Right.
So, you know, the fact that I'd done something like that, or that I was just a teacher, didn't add up to what I was being told about autism. You know, it didn't fit. Because we were being informed that autistic children in school couldn't do anything like that. You know, they couldn't get on stage and do stuff. They could, because it was beyond them, you know, the very, very old fashioned, very stereotyped information, unfortunately. So I had to I discounted that for years and years. But I had a friend whose son was autistic, and you know, just in conversation, I was like, God, he feels so familiar to me. You know, this right. kid, you know, yeah. the things that he's struggling with. You know, looking back at my own childhood, and just little things like that started to add up. And I'll never forget, my partner at the time pointed me in the direction of one of the questionnaires you can do online.
Yeah.
It's one of those very rare circumstances where online questionnaires can actually be quite valid. That doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
But I filled one in. I think it was the AQ test, the autism quotient test, which is one of the ones that they tend to use when they diagnose you, you know, as a kind of preliminary screening kind of thing. And I filled it in, and I think any score above 30 was meant to raise question marks, and I think I got 70 something. So, you know, I was like, okay, this looks like it could be something. And it went from there. But there were certain moments, you know, that were very luck based. You know, if I hadn't had those moments of realization or those conversations with people, it might never have happened. So.
And when you went to your GP, you say that you can convince them to agree with you. I think that's the phrase you use. Was it a matter of you'd done enough sort of research of your own to feel pretty confident? And but you obviously you in order to get the referral, you need them to be on board. So was that straightforward or not?
It was for me. I had done my homework, and I turned up with, you know, notes and research that I'd done, and I was very detailed. You know, I took the opportunity, which is unusual for me because normally in a doctor's appointment, I just want to get out as quick as I can. I don't like them very much. But this time I really, you know, went into some detail. And yeah, I got referred straight away, and I was diagnosed within a year. But I had a lot going for me in that regard because I was a man, which helps when it comes to autism diagnosis. You know, I'm white, middle class. You know, all of these things really go a long way because autism's massively underdiagnosed in all the other demographics. You know, if you're a woman, if you're black, you're far less likely to, because that stereotype still persists that, you know, autistic people are white, male. You know, basically, it's really insidious. So I got a diagnosis relatively easily, but you talk to, I mean, I know a fair few autistic women, for example, and it was a nightmare to get that diagnosis. People just refuse to go down that avenue, you know, and they get misdiagnosed and told that they're just, you know, there's nothing wrong, you know, there's nothing going on there. It's a bit of a tricky topic, you know, and that's why, of course, it was seen as being a male condition for so long, because nobody was diagnosing the women. You
Right,
know,
so
and the wrong.
there was data that seemed to suggest it was more prevalent amongst men, but
Yes,
that's
for a long
because
time.
women were reporting it less, or doctors were struggling to make the connection between their
Yeah,
symptoms and the condition.
the diagnostic criteria was so heavily weighted towards masculine things and
Right,
masculine
right.
responses. You know, it was interestingly a very gendered set of diagnostic criteria. And it didn't take into account what we call autistic masking, which is where autistic people kind of hide their autisticness, you know, in order to survive without being bullied to death, you know. And as we are aware now, it seems that autistic women seem to be more proficient at an earlier age with masking, you know, and therefore that data wasn't there. But it's little things like, I don't know, like the association of autistic people with trains, for example, or video games. Very, very common, very, very common kind of idea that, you know, autistic people love video games, they love trains. But of course, that's fairly gendered. Not totally, but it is. You can see that there is a gender thing going on there. You know, when the reality is that autistic special interests can be blooming anything, you know, absolutely anything, from goodness knows what to, you know, I mean, from either gender perspective or whatever. You know, it can be very, very widespread. So yeah, in little ways, things were really gendered, and thus I found it easy, but a lot of people do not. And I'm grateful for that, you know.
What were your impressions of, or your sense of what autism was before you started looking into it and before you got your own diagnosis? And how did that change what when you learned the reality?
Well, on top of the training that I had as a teacher, which, like I said, was very old-fashioned and actually fed into this idea that it was a very male thing. You know, for example, we weren't taught or trained to expect to teach autistic girls at all. Not that I can remember anyway, even in the 2010s, you know, which is just phenomenal. But before that, the only other info about autism that I remember coming across was reading the Mark Haddon book, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. You know, that detective story with the main character, Christopher, who investigates the death of the dog next door. And he's described as being autistic. And that was my understanding of autism. A young boy who who was impeccably logical, fascinated by science and maths, who had very strong sensory sensitivities that I didn't share particularly. Basically what that book provided us with was a very narrow window on a particular type of autistic person, because when we talk about the autism spectrum, a lot of people seem to think that the autism spectrum is something that we're all on. It's like a spectrum that every human being is on somewhere, but that's a misconception. The autism spectrum is a spectrum that all autistic people are on. And people who aren't autistic, I'm afraid you're not. and it's described like that because, we're so bloody varied, in how being autistic affects us and how our being autistic presents to the world and to ourselves. So when you read a book like The Curious Incident, you're seeing a very narrow, you're looking through a very narrow window at one particular type of autistic person. But I didn't know that. I thought that was autism pretty much anyway. And because I didn't resonate that much with Christopher, how could it be? It's interesting, actually, that since diagnosis, I've realized that I actually resonate with Christopher far more than I realized.
Right. Yeah.
I was talking about this. I went to a school to do some training the other week, and we were talking about, I have this odd kind of superstition thing going on. A lot of my life is driven by what I describe as a fairly rational superstition. So if a day goes well, I'll try to replicate it as best as I can. If a day goes badly, I'll try to never do those things again. So I don't know, if a day goes badly and I realize that I brush my teeth at 10 a.m. rather than 9 a.m. on that day, then I'm not waiting till 10 a.m. to brush my teeth again, just in case.
Yeah.
And I realized that in the book Curious Incident, Christopher has this whole thing with the yellow cars. If he sees a yellow car, that means it's going to be a bad day. And when I read that originally, I took that the wrong way. I took it as a kind of cause and effect thing.
Yeah.
But actually, I can recognize it as a, in the past, Christopher has had a really bad day and he remembers seeing a yellow car that earlier that day and makes the connection.
The association.
I can kind of get with that. It's something that I really do have going on with myself. So that's been quite interesting, It just goes to show how reflecting on things, things can really change and look very different when you've got the information that you need.
Well, this is one of the things that I really was interested to ask you about, was it's a relatively late in life diagnosis you had. So was it like looking back on your whole life through a new pair of sort of spectacles? And what were the things that you started to see and interpret differently from your childhood and the whole of your life up until that point of diagnosis? What were the things that you reflected on? I guess in everything, really. So.
Yeah, it's astonishing. The process was lengthy for me anyway.
Was it stressful and was it like traumatizing to sort of have to almost like reassess your life to that degree?
At times it was, but it veered more towards the comforting in the end for me, as I reevaluated everything. Because as I mentioned earlier, there was a lot of self-hatred going on, an awful lot. I think anyone who feels that they're not coping in the world when everyone else seems to be relatively fine, from our perception anyway, can empathize with that. I think it's very easy to blame yourself and to view yourself as being flawed and a bit rubbish, a bit crap as a person. So finding out that there was at least cause for a lot of it, cause that other people would empathize with and would understand. Not everybody, of course, that's half the problem, but at least there were other autistic people out there who would go, I had that too. That's nice. That feels like belonging and you're not alone in this unhappiness. But I likened it at the time. I remember talking to my therapist at the time. So I've managed to get a therapist through the NHS because of the depression. And I remember describing it as like I was defragging my brain. Going back to an old computer term that I think computers still do it, but they do it automatically now. Back in my day, you had to direct a computer to do it.
Right, yeah.
And you know, what it does is it takes all the data that's kind of scattered about and consolidates it like a game of Tetris, kind of swaps it all into place to take up less space and to become more efficient. And I felt like I was doing that with my brain. I was taking all these things and this new piece of information, I was able to make it all make more sense and become more efficient. And I mean, it was things like my disorganization, which has been epically, almost comical throughout my life.
Yeah.
I now had some understanding of why that was. Social relationships, you know, of all kinds, friendships, romantic relationships. Now things made a little more sense. Why I didn't pick up on signals, perhaps, or why I'd missed massive things going on, just, you know, pass me by. Why I might have, you know, started arguments or things like that through misunderstanding something. All of that started to make more sense. And my, more specifically, my struggles and my stresses in work and as a parent suddenly made a lot more sense. When I discovered that sensory sensitivity was a thing, and that it seems that my sensory sensitivity is highly based on sound, bad smells, and texture and touch and feel. All of a sudden, becoming a parent and how that affected me made more sense. You know, I've suddenly got this being in the house that screams and cries a lot, which is really bad for somebody who's very sensitive to sound. You know, really very, very. I mean, this morning I was having coffee and there was a car opposite me with that engine idling, and I had to get up and walk away. I couldn't sit in the vicinity of that rumbly noise at all. So having a baby in the house crying a lot, you know, not sleeping just, you know,
and the bad smells of all those nappies
and the bad smells.
Well.
I was the nappy changer.
It's
and
the perfect storm.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, I look back now and it's like, no wonder I struggled, whereas before, why am I struggling? And there's a big difference between the two feelings.
There's a lot of self-forgiveness.
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
is, I think must be really liberating in lots of ways.
It is. And also it can work proactively now as well.
Mm.
I can forgive myself if I realize I can't do something, you know, because I've hit a wall. So if I have to cancel something or I have to, I don't know, go to bed at 8 o'clock or whatever it might be, because, you know, I've worn myself out. I can give myself a break for that now rather than, what's wrong with me? For goodness sake, why am I so hopeless at all of this? Which is obviously tremendously liberating and engenders a far more positive relationship with myself, I suppose.
So what were the first steps once you received the official diagnosis? What did the NHS do? What kind of process do you go into?
Nothing.
Right.
Absolutely nothing. They gave me some pamphlets that were badly photocopied, often directing you to resources that no longer existed.
Oh, my God.
You know, there'd be websites and it'd be like error 404 or whatever. They don't signpost you to, you know, further therapy or give you, I don't know, a couple of months of free counselling or anything like that. Certainly not when I did it in 2017. Mm. And I doubt very much things have improved. It was very much a, hey, you're autistic, congratulations, off you pop, and see if you can cope with that massive, life-changing piece of information. So, I mean, I laughed out of discomfort more than anything.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it's absolutely scandalous.
Yeah.
But that's what happens. I mean, I was lucky. I went online and I started to seek things out. And I was on Twitter. At that point, I was just a lurker on Twitter, really. Mm. But I started following autistic accounts and started watching videos on YouTube made by autistic creators and started to find a community and started to make sense of it. And then started to write my own stuff as well as I kind of you know, got to grips with everything. But you know, not everyone's gonna have the resources or the space in their head to do that kind of thing, you know. And the fact that we're just kind of waved goodbye and, you know, left to our own devices is absolutely terrible, in my opinion. But I made the best of it as best as I could. I was possibly a little bit too over eager to share this new piece of information with my workplace, looking back. It's a very interesting topic, disclosure. Who do you tell? Who do you inform about this? Because there's such a layer of taboo. Well, taboo and prejudice and all kinds of things, really. When you tell somebody that you're autistic or that you're ADHD or whatever neurodivergence it might be, some people will react very positively and be very kind and pleasant, and you know, ask what they can do and can they? Is there anything they could adapt to make your life a happier one? And that's lovely, but that's not necessarily the norm. A lot of people think they're trying to be nice, but a lot of people disbelieve you. A lot of people say things like, "No." The best one is, "Don't be so hard on yourself," as if you know you're just kind of, I don't know, making excuses or
Make
something.
yeah, or that you're saying it almost as a gag, like, oh,
Yeah,
I think
like a
I'm autistic.
self-deprecating joke or something. "Oh, I'm autistic," you
So that's all. So that's like awareness for wider society is that's a big problem, and I guess that leads me on as well to like. Obviously, autism is not a mental health, it's not a mental illness, but you know, it does seem to be linked. You know, you have a propensity towards mental health challenges if you are autistic. Is it partly linked to the fact that you're in a society that doesn't understand your condition? Is that where it's coming from?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all autistic people will disagree to a certain extent on this. There are some out there who would say that it's 100% society. You know, that if society was better, then we wouldn't have any issues at all. Others will say, "Well, you know, I could live on an island with nobody and still have some problems." I don't really know where I fall with this. I think society has an awful lot to answer for. I think that the way my brain works means that anxiety, at the very least, is probably more likely to happen than not. Even if I lived in a perfect society, I've got a feeling that anxiety would still be a
Presumably, just
looming
the
thing.
living with that like hypersensitivity
Yeah, yeah.
is going to be in any situation, even if you're completely alone, is going to be quite, you know, anxious to live with. I mean, you know, it can't be easy.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, if society, even if society did literally everything it could to be more inclusive, then, you know, there would still be times where my anxiety would rocket because of just sensory issues, if nothing else. So yeah, it's a tricky one. But I mean, you know, my second book was all about how the world isn't built for autistic people, or certainly isn't built with us in mind at all, and how that has a massive, you know, gigantic effect on the autistic population. These days, in order to shock audiences, whenever I give a talk or a speech or whatever it is that I'm doing, I do tend to lead with the statistics to do with life expectancy and suicidality and depression rates and those kind of things. Because, you know, ultimately, the reason that autistic people are, you know, way more likely to attempt suicide than non-autistic people, is because we're living in a world which is seemingly often dead stacked against us. Where and not only that, but there's very little understanding of how we're struggling with that. And even if we do try and bring it up and raise the issues, we tend to be ignored. I mean, you think about an autistic child complaining that they're too hot. Now, imagine that the day is only about 20 degrees and the kid is complaining that they're too hot. They're only wearing a t-shirt. "I'm too hot, Daddy, I'm too hot." You know, the neurotypical people around this kid are going to be like, "It's not hot. It's not hot at all. This, what on earth? You're just being silly." And that's what they get told. You know, stop being silly. Stop making a fuss. All autistic people, I reckon, personally, can look back at their lives and see all those times they were just flat out dismissed, disbelieved, told that they're just, you know, being, I don't know, attention seeking or,
Difficult, yeah, difficult, really, isn't it?
When, yeah, it is. Well, when I can vouch personally that when you have that temperature discomfort, which is going to be different to the temperatures that another person might feel, it is all encompassing. You know, I have to regulate my temperature so carefully because if things creep above 20, 21 degrees for me, then I literally start to stop working. I like just things start to shut down, not physically, but mentally. Like my capacity just decreases drastically. So yeah, but we just get told to suck it up. Don't be silly. Don't be daft. And you soon learn to keep your mouth shut.
Is the at least then being diagnosed and knowing, being aware that you have this is, you know, in most ways is better for your mental health. But what's worrying is that I think I've read a stat or probably in something you've written is that so many people remain undiagnosed. I mean, you did into your mid-30s. And that seems to be, I mean, there may be people who, you know, have got severe mental health issues. I'm sure there are in society. And the problem really is undiagnosed autism.
Yeah, absolutely. And who knows how many?
Yeah.
It's so difficult to say. The accepted number or the accepted rate of autism keeps climbing. And of course, people panic about that and they say things like, oh, there's a pandemic of autism and, you know, wow, it's spreading. And it's like, no. It's always been there. We're just getting much better at identifying it. And actually, there have always been way, way more autistic people out there than you'd ever realized. You know, everyone probably knows at least one autistic person, whether they know it themselves or not. We're a big minority, probably a lot bigger than anyone thought. I think the most recent figures are looking somewhere 1 in 30, but it might be even higher than that. And if you take neurodivergence more generally, so ADHD, dyspraxia, dyslexia, dyscalculia, Tourette's, etc., the rate becomes something like 1 in 10, maybe even more. You know, it's time the world woke up a little bit to the fact that, you know, one size fits all when it comes to things to do with the most important things of all, like percepting reality and communication and the way that we organize ourselves does not work. Because I did a post on Instagram a while back that did quite well. It basically said something like, why are we so surprised that something as deeply, obviously complicated as the brain has so much variation?
Yeah.
Like, surely it was arrogant to think that brains were pretty much kind of uniform.
Standard issue,
Yeah, and that anything diverting or diverging from that is somehow bad. It's bewildering to think that way. You know, the brain is so complicated, we can't even understand it. You know, so thinking that it could possibly be anything approaching uniform was just folly. But we're still counting the cost of that. And we need to shift towards a realization that brains are incredibly different and the way people perceive reality is incredibly different. And assuming that people view the world in the same way that you do, not you personally, but, you know, you generally, is deeply arrogant and prone to terrible catastrophic failure. But, you know, that's a big thing for society to accept and acknowledge. You know, society doesn't like to be told that things are more complicated than we think, as we know.
Well, it's a good reason to not be on Twitter, as you say. Nuance is not something that's widely popular. No. So a lot of the things you're talking about, you know, just those feelings where you feel bad about yourself, you feel as if, you know, you've been told or dismissed many times that you're just being difficult, which is, I guess, what people would now call, to put in the modern idiom, gaslighting, really, to a large extent. Yeah. It's like, you know, you feel that there's a problem and everyone around you says there isn't. Even people who are apparently compassionate towards you, like your parents who love you, but they'll still say, oh, no, come on, like, you're overdoing it a bit or whatever. The issues you have with parenting, which, as I said at the beginning, very common amongst, you know, a lot of the men who I interview on this podcast, you know, a lot of people will recognize some of the things you said, if not all, in themselves. So how do we know whether this is something? Because obviously, that not if you have one of these traits or one of these symptoms, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are on the autism spectrum, does it? But what's your advice to people who might be sitting there listening to your story and thinking, you know what, maybe I need to look into this a bit?
Yeah. I mean, I've had a lot of people over the course of the last 5 years or so come to me and tell me that they've been diagnosed as a direct result of something that I've written, which I still can't quite sort of put in. I don't know how, you know, that's a big thing to be told.
Yeah.
It really is, you know, because it's such a life-changing experience. You know, I feel that there's enormous responsibility there. but you know, if I'm helping people with that, then that's great. I mean, if you are sitting there listening to this or anything else to do with autism, thinking, my God, this sounds very familiar. Basically, people react to that in one of two ways. They either think he's just talking about humanity and how humans work, so it's just all nonsense, you know, he's just looking for special treatment. Or, my God, I might be autistic, I better look into this. So I want to address both, if I may.
Yeah, absolutely.
The first response is very, very common. You know, people hear, well, I have sensory sensitivity. You know, I don't like it when it's too hot. I don't like it when it's too noisy. So you're just, you know, all you're describing is normal human experience. Mm. The first point is that nearly everything that autistic people experience is normal human experience at a fundamental level. There isn't very much to do with being autistic that is totally alien or totally different to, you know, to your standard kind of whatever you would describe as normal human experience. It's just switched up higher, you know. So yes, obviously the joke I always make is that no one likes wet socks. You know, no one likes that. That is a sensory sensation that people generally hate. Loads of people hate coriander. I get that, you know. There's a reason we have air conditioning, because human beings do have a temperature intolerance. But for autistic people, it's more than that.
Yeah.
Our ability to tolerate it might be less. The things that we do intolerate will be greater. The stress we feel as a result of these sensations will be probably higher. And we're almost certainly going to have a far greater list of things that we can't cope with. So it's, yes, it's a human experience, but it's mushroomed, you know, there's more to it, and when we experience it more frequently. The same thing with autistic meltdowns, with what we call stimming. You know, people always look at autistic stimming, which is when we do that, we do kind of repetitive movements to calm ourselves down. People often look at that and think, oh, that's weird, you know, I would never do anything like that, they say, as they pace backwards and forwards whilst making a difficult phone call or whilst playing with their hair because they're stressed. Everybody stims. It's just autistic stims might be a bit more obvious, a bit more unique, you know? So, you may well be listening to this and thinking, well, this just describes normal humanity, but it does to an extent, but you just have to acknowledge that it's greater. There's more of it. And the stress we feel as a result is far, far higher. You know, because it's very difficult to live in a world where your senses really are very sensitive to the things around you, far more than a non-autistic person might realize. But the second point is, you might be hearing this thinking, you know, wow, this sounds familiar. Maybe I'm autistic. In which case, do some homework. You know, I wouldn't recommend going straight to the GP, you know, without kind of doing a bit of preliminary research. But get out there, read some books, watch some videos, listen to some podcasts, follow some autistic people on the various social medias. You know, immerse yourself in that world a bit and see how much of it rings true and how much of it you're thinking, my God, you know, this. Because often I get told, you're like, I'll write something and somebody will say, how have you got into my head? How are you telling me exactly how I felt all my life? And that seems to be the threshold. It's when people think, oh my God, everything here fits. That's when you might want to start thinking, you know, diagnosis, start to progress down that avenue. Because the undiagnosed are out there in huge numbers.
and what, just lastly, it's actually a big one to leave till last. I know you won't be able to cover everything you'd like to see change, but for the rest of us in society, you know, who are who lack awareness, as you've explained, that, you know, society does, what are the little things we could start adjusting about our day to day or our thought process to make it, you know, a sort of a kinder and an easier world for people who are on the spectrum to live in?
I think the biggest one, and it, I think I genuinely believe it would be quite easy to do if people knew about it. The biggest one is to believe.
Yeah.
To especially if if you know that the person is autistic, but even if you don't, to believe other people's experiences, even if they don't correlate with your own. I think that's the biggest one. Again, it's about that arrogance of thinking that everyone's perception is the same.
Yeah.
So if somebody does come up to you at work or at school or in your family and say, look, you know, I don't know what it could be like. Please could you be less ambiguous when you speak to me? Or please could you put into writing when you want me to do something? I'd really benefit from that. That'd be really helpful. Just be like, okay, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah,
that's fine. Rather than what seems to be the default, which is what? No. why have I got to do that? You know, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
Or don't be daft. That's not going to help. Or any of those various ways that disbelief or dismissal can be expressed. That for me is the biggest one. And obviously, it's very broad, but it's. I don't think it's particularly tricky. I think it's
a good design for life. I think it could translate to politics and society generally, to be honest.
Well, no. Indeed. The fact is,
empathy, I guess, is wrapped in with that, isn't it? Which we could all do with a bit more of, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And I think empathy thrives from knowledge. I think we're far more likely to empathise with something that we understand, which is why getting the information out there is important too. You know, because the moment somebody's heard, even if they just kind of heard it on the wind somewhere, you know, that autistic people struggle with sound sensitivity, for example.
Yeah.
And they see a kid wearing ear defenders or a family member says, look, I've got to leave. It's too noisy in here. I just need to go and be in a quiet space. I believe they are, if they've heard the rumor of this, if they've heard, picked it up from somewhere, they saw a tweet or they've heard it somewhere, they're far more likely to be, oh, okay, yeah, that rings a bell. I've come across something like that before. I can't remember what it is. I can't remember it's to do with autism. But yeah, I kind of know about that, and therefore, fair enough.
Yeah.
I think that's the key, because I do genuinely believe that once we've become slightly aware of something, we're far more likely to accept it. It's, for as long as autism remains a mystery, which I think it does to most people, empathy can't exist in that situation. You know, we don't empathize towards mysterious things. We don't feel empathy towards the unknown or towards things that we can't recognize. And I think that's the problem. So if we can, you know, raise awareness and understanding enough that there is no mystery any longer, then I think empathy might follow.
Peter, what a wonderful chat. I mean, I'm delighted just to have learned from you so much about this issue. And, you know, hopefully, you know, we've communicated to people who might feel as if they're undiagnosed and other people who just need to understand, you know, what life is like for someone who's on the spectrum. I think that's really valuable. You speak about it beautifully and powerfully, and I'm really grateful for your time. And like I say, you know, I know from the feedback I've had from people that your book is making such a big difference to people. And I hope you feel rightfully very proud about that, because it's amazing.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Hopefully, yes. And hopefully it will continue to do so. But thank you for having me. It's been great to have a good chat about things.
Nice one. Okay. Peter Warmby. Thanks.
That was Peter Warmby. His book, Untypical, is a bestseller, and I can recommend it. I'll put a link in the show notes. Thanks as always for listening, gang. Please subscribe to The Reset if you don't already via samdelaney.substack.com. Paid subscribers get a bunch of extra content every month, plus invites to live events and much more, all for less than the price of a pint. Anyway, until next time, be lucky and don't let the dickheads get you down.